To Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 28th of August 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at radioalbion.com. Normally we would have Dennis Wise with us, but before I introduce my guest tonight, I will just give an update on Dennis's welfare. He's still not well, but he has got an appointment with a specialist, but not for another 8 weeks. So he's asked me to relay that information to you, the listeners, and to thank you all for your prayers and all your well wishes. Maybe we'll be able to do something pre-recorded with him. Maybe we won't. He's not up to a state where he can actually make podcasts at the moment, but he is okay. We do know what the problem is, and he is going to be seeing a specialist soon. Well, once again tonight, we do have the author of Scalp Dance, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate, Bloody Dawn, The Darkest Dawn, Bleeding Kansas, and the book we will be talking about tonight, Hellstorm, Mr. Thomas Goodrich. Tom, good evening, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Sven. How about yourself?
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. I really enjoyed our conversation last week. That went down very well with the listeners. I thought we got into a lot of deep subjects, and we really just brushed the surface. I thought there's a hell of a lot more stuff to get into, if you ignore the pun there. So I was, you know, I've got a list of stuff here. I had a list of stuff last week, but what you went into, it covered half of it anyway, and it just seemed to be much better when we did it in a conversational way rather than me sort of just asking you these questions one after the other. What were your thoughts about last week's podcast?
Oh, I enjoyed it. It's very rare when I actually enjoy an interview, because quite honestly, it takes a bit of work. Even if you know your subject fairly well, you still have to think and ponder certain things before you speak generally. And nobody wants to say something stupid or something that's inaccurate or something that's false. And so interviewing is, at least from this perspective, my perspective, it's taxing. It's not hard work. It's not digging a ditch or anything like that. I've done that too in my life, but it's still taxing. But I enjoyed it. I was less taxed talking with you last week than generally I am.
Well, I'm very, very, very pleased to hear that. It's quite moving, some of the subjects that you were going into. You talked about the rape and the starvation of the Germans after the war, and Eisenhower, and how your views of Eisenhower as a president changed after finding that out. And we talked a bit about the media and the effect that the media had on these soldiers that caused them to do this. And I know there are some other subjects in the book that we didn't get into. One of them was the terror bombing of the civilians. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, some of the things you discovered about that and what went on there?
Yeah, we could do that. The terror bombing, the fire bombing, the deliberate attempt to kill every man, woman, and child down below in German cities that long before had lost all military value whatsoever. The attempt to kill these people was just a simple attempt by Churchill, basically, to destroy Germany utterly, especially its large cities, and they did a very good job of it. The first such instance of terror bombing began in 1943 when the RAF and a huge armada of bombers raided Hamburg. Hamburg is the second largest city in Germany. And prior to this raid in the summer of 1943, Hamburg had only been slightly touched. While other cities were being bombed, their industry and the railroads, things like that, Hamburg had not felt much of the war, quite honestly. And there was a lot of speculation among people in Hamburg itself. Why? Why, when every other German city is being bombed, why are we getting off so lightly? And people speculated. They thought maybe Churchill's mother lived there. They thought because Hamburg, I think then, not so much now, but then was known as the most English of all German cities. And there was other speculation, but the people were grateful for whatever was the cause that kept them from being blown to bits like most other German cities. Well, one night in the summer of 1943, all those thoughts, those wished for reasons why it hadn't been bombed ended rather abruptly when roughly, I want to say 1,000, but let's say 800 RAF bombers, Lancasters, came in and just dropped ton after ton after ton of bombs on the heart of Hamburg, a beautiful old city, of course, like most German cities, was just utterly destroyed. After about an hour of nonstop bombing, and the people who had found their way to their air raid shelters, when they finally came out and saw what had happened, they were heartbroken, of course. This beautiful, wonderful city of canals and lakes and rivers had been utterly destroyed by the high explosive bombs that were dropped upon the city. And of course, thousands upon thousands of people were dead. That was bad enough. That's what the people found when they came out that summer night, 1943. But things got worse in a hurry. About an hour later, the sirens went off one more time. This time, the British returned with more bombers. But this time, the bombers were carrying not high explosives, but incendiaries, that is, firebombs. Bombs, much smaller, but bombs that would ignite upon impact with a home, a church, a hospital, a hotel. And the people had raced back into their underground shelters, of course, but they were designed, these shelters, for high explosive attacks. They were not designed for firebombs. And no one else, of course, in the world had ever experienced that either. But the long and short of the story is this, that the fire caught among the splinters and the destroyed buildings. You know, many German cities back then, as well as English cities today, are made of wood. And so it was an easy thing for these incendiary bombs to ignite the shattered debris of Hamburg. Fires caught from all parts of the cities. They race together. You know, the firestorm has a hurricane wind of its own. It's updraft, sucking air up and away, trying to get more food, more air just to stay alive, the fire itself. And so we had a situation. There was a huge vortex of flame right in the middle of the city. And some people say it went as high as 3 miles. That's how ferocious this fire was. Now, I don't know if it went 3 miles or 2 miles or 1 mile. It doesn't matter. It was a tornado of fire. And the winds were of hurricane force in the city. And those people who realized that now their former safety shelters now were just death traps. They were ovens, and people tried to escape these things. And many could not, of course, but those who did flee the shelters in this firestorm raced right into the fire itself. And the flames were everywhere, as I said, and the wind, the hurricane force winds now were taking over and actually sucking people into the fire itself. People who weren't stuck in the asphalt and ignited into flames as they were trying to get out of the asphalt, were actually swept in like autumn leaves into the center of the firestorm. So that is Hamburg. And this is something else that occurred in Hamburg and it happened in every other German city afterwards. Those people who survived everything and somehow miraculously escaped Hamburg and its flames, the next day, of course, they did everything they could to get out of the city and find refuge in the countryside. Well, the Americans and the British were there too for the refugees, the women, the children, the old. They were shooting them with their fighter planes, shooting them on the roads, killing as many people as they possibly could. Well, that's the pattern that was set for the next year and a half of bombing of Germany. The cities that were formerly very important to the military endeavor were of none now, but nevertheless, they were still targeted one after the other. And it was a deliberate attempt to exterminate everyone in every German city, quite simply. And they did a very good job. But every German city over a certain size, over 50,000 population generally, sometimes over 25,000 population, was targeted for the terror bombing, the firebombing. And that, of course, was a high crime in anyone's opinion. That was, except for the Allies, of course. And to them, the Germans were getting what they deserved. Now, 1943, there is a period where there was very little terror bombing going on. But then prior to the onslaught, full onslaught of firebombing, there was still a debate about who was going to win this war. Was it going to be Germany and the Axis, or would it be the Allies? When the Allies finally realized that Germany was not going to win this, and its Axis, Italy and the other nations, Hungary, Romania, then all bets were off, and they just poured on the coals, so to speak. Again, there's a poor pun, but and so every city, name a city, and the city was destroyed from firebombings, because the Allies knew that there was no longer any threat of losing the war, so there was no threat of something like occurred at Nuremberg, a war crimes tribunal, judging them in a war courtroom, So since they knew they were going to win the war, they could do anything they wanted to Germany, and who was going to say no? Who was going to hold them guilty for what they were doing, these terrible crimes? The worst, I wasn't alive then, and the people, I only have the sources when I was doing the research of the book, the people who did survive these terrible bombings, these firestorms, these terror bombings. And so this is all I have to go on. I didn't experience any of that myself, but I read enough accounts to finally form an opinion about the whole thing. And it was an indiscriminate slaughter of all Germans, women, children, generally the old people, the only ones still in the cities. And we're talking every city in Germany, not just the big ones. Not the ones we've heard of, Hamburg and Dresden and Berlin. We're even small cities. For instance, the firestorm I just described in Hamburg took place also in Dresden. It was probably the worst of all of them because there were so many people packed in the city of Dresden the night it was attacked, February 13th, 14th, 1945. But everyone, hopefully by now, knows something about Dresden, what happened there. But what they don't know is generally things like, well, 2 weeks later after Dresden, when the world was finally showing some horror at all of this nonstop slaughter, 2 weeks after Dresden was destroyed, and maybe as many as 400,000 people died in that one, 2 weeks after that, Forzheim, a much smaller city, I think a city of roughly 50,000, was attacked with firebombs. And for the next 15 minutes, the bombs came down, and roughly half the population of Forzheim was burnt alive. No, not too many people know that story, but I believe it was around 10 or 15,000 people that died in Forzheim. So this was a policy that was in place. It was going to stay in place no matter how many people complained about it, no matter whether Churchill had his reservations, as he said he did after Dresden. Didn't matter. This still went on right to the bitter end. And there's something I need to say also about your introduction, and I think you said it the last time. The book is not just about the post-war years, the peace. When you talk about the slaughter of people, the starvation, the rape, it also occurs during the war. It's just that after the war, when the Allies had won, then they didn't have to worry at all about anything because no one was going to hold them into account for this. And the horror continued in at least the first 2 years after the war. And it took 70 years before we found out about it. I had never in my research, when I began my research, I had never heard of almost everything that's in this book, Hellstorm. Almost everything was new to me. It was a terrible revelation to realize what was going on. Because quite honestly, up until that point, I actually believed in the war. I was like most Americans. I was like most English-speaking people, I suppose. But to this very day, it still startles me.
It's absolutely scandalous. It's absolutely scandalous. I mean, I was just thinking there with this bombing. I mean, it was specifically thought out that if the people were going to go running into their air raid shelters, they needed bombs that were going to set fire to the air raid shelters. It was specific targeting of civilians, yes. And obviously, targeting of civilians is a war crime. And of course, that wasn't brought up at all in Nuremberg. And when you were pointing out there that they were doing this because they knew they weren't going to lose the war, I mean, up until that point, I've been thinking, well, what could have been going through their minds? We need to win this war. We want to win this war as quickly as possible. What's the way that we can win it? Overwhelming firepower. I mean, they did the same in Japan with the atom bomb. Overwhelming firepower, overwhelming terrifying of the civilians, and we'll win the war quickly. And it would be over and done with as quickly as possible. That's the only sort of way of thinking that I can think of that would have been that they would have thought that sort of thing would have been acceptable. But if it's as you say, and Germany had lost the war anyway when they did that, then that's completely unforgivable, don't you think?
Yes, it is. And what you're pointing out is correct, absolutely correct. I should have mentioned that, yes, in fact, you mentioned Japan. Virtually the same thing was going on in Japan, but they extended the war even longer and longer when they could have made peace months and months and months before. They kept refusing to make peace with Japan because, quite honestly, they were winning the war and they were enjoying it. They were enjoying the massacre, and the American people and the British people were enjoying it too. Very much the same thing happened in Germany. Yes, they could have, had they not demanded unconditional surrender, which meant that the Germans would give up everything, basically, and they would just bare their throats. Here's my throat, cut it with a knife. That's what unconditional surrender is all about, and it continued and continued when long ago the Allies could have made peace with Germany. There's no doubt whatsoever. But the hatred was so great, the propaganda so terrible, that the longer this went on, the happier the people felt. I'm talking about the normal people in America and Britain. Yes, not to mention the leaders who actually hated Germany with passion. I want to say something too about the terror bombing, and you brought it up also, Sven. It was a plan. The plan was, and it started it with Hamburg, was yes, come in, blow a town to bits, and then leave. As if you're going for good, knowing that people would come out, knowing that rescue workers would come in to try to save the people, knowing that the people themselves would come out looking for lost loved ones. And that's when the firebombings came in about an hour or two later and catching the people outside, out of their bunkers, out of the shelters. And that was a deliberate, preconceived plan on the part of the Allies. That is so an evil, so terrible, in my estimation, that I even though the Allies won, it's too bad that there wasn't a power great enough to hold them into account for what they had done, this terrific evil, this massacre on a massive scale. Nothing like this has ever happened in world history. Nothing like this.
Never. They always, when they had these battles, sorry to interrupt you there, when they had these battles, they would stop and they would have a ceasefire and they would go out and they would rescue the wounded and they would even have a set time to finish and they wouldn't fight on Sundays. And I mean, even before they had this don't fight on Sundays and, you know, we'll stop for tea or we'll stop at 5 o'clock, they always stopped to go out and get the wounded. To do anything less than that would have been just uncivilized. Unchivalrous, unwhite, basically. It's not the white way to behave, is it?
No, it isn't. No, you're bringing up some great points here. And except for the Eastern Front, which almost defied logic, defied rules, the things that went on there, even over there. You know, the Fighting Man is one of the least, an individual least likely to harbor hatred very long, because they know what it's like. They didn't know what it's like to be shot at and be wounded and live in mud and eat garbage. And because the guy on the other side is doing the same thing. And so there is a much greater area of where there is some humanity. Yes, it happened that people could go out and bring back in their wounded. But again, it's fairly relative. Here in America, they try to paint the Western Front as somehow much more civilized and much more Western. It makes it seem less harsh, less vicious than the Eastern Front. And it may have been to a point, but from the research of this book and the next book, which you're talking about, maybe we'll discuss next week, the Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate, I didn't find too much difference in the Western Front and the Eastern Front. I truly didn't. The Americans were murdering POWs, people who would come forward, German soldiers, the Wehrmacht, or SS, or the Home Guards, old men and boys, and would murder them outright. There was a policy, basically, that you will not accept any prisoners. You won't take surrender. It was an understood command, too. It wasn't codified. It wasn't official, because no one wanted to actually face a jail term after the war, when some senator in America might have actually got something going against them. But nevertheless, it was almost a no quarter war on both fronts, the Eastern and the Western Front. And I didn't find much to apologize for on the West, because the Americans were raping, they were looting, they were killing, they were murdering, and it was a badge of honor, quite honestly. Eisenhower, of course, when you have the very top man who hates Germans and who doesn't stop the things that are occurring, because he enjoys what's happening. The more dead Germans, the better he feels, at least. So there was terrible, terrible things going on during the war, and of course after the war. And rape is one of the worst things of all. I don't want to talk too much. I think we talked about some of these things the last time, so I don't want to. I'm going to let you ask more questions so that I don't repeat the same answers.
No, that was great. I don't think we've gone over anything that we already talked about. But another thing that doesn't really get talked about that much is what happened nautically, what happened at sea. And I'm remembering back, and I did a podcast with Dennis, and we were talking about Churchill and how he was responsible for changing the laws at sea and using civilian ships and putting weapons on them so that they could then fire on the U-boats, so that the U-boats then ended up having a policy of not picking up the people not picking up any survivors, because they would be fired on by these ships. And I was just wondering what else happened during the war nautically, because we've seen here that civilians were being bombed. They were attacking the civilians like that, the Allies were. And I know that there were some things like that happened nautically as well. But can you tell us about some of the bad behavior that happened at sea on the part of the Allies?
Yes, unfortunately, I can. You know, we grew up believing that the Titanic, with 1,500 deaths, and the Lusitania with 1,200 deaths, the sinkings, these were the greatest nautical disasters in world history. They were not even close. What was going on at sea, especially the Baltic Sea, where the German civilians were trying to escape the Red Army that was approaching with speed. Everybody was afraid of the Red Army because, quite honestly, the propaganda from Berlin was telling them, look, these are terrible people. Well, most people actually didn't believe what Dr. Goebbels, the propaganda minister, was saying. He thought that was just propaganda to keep the moral up, to keep the morale up, to keep the courage up. But no, the propaganda coming from Berlin was nothing compared to the reality. Actually, it was much, much worse than Goebbels had told the people. And one account, one instance of this terrible slaughter, just like in the cities being bombed. There was an attempt to destroy everybody in the cities, not just a few, not just in the middle or the outside of the city, all of the cities. The same thing was happening on the Baltic Sea. These pathetic refugees in rags with their children and the old people trying to escape the Red Army that was closing in from all areas. There was very few ways to get away, and land was pretty much not an option by this late stage of the war, late 1944, early 1945, and only the Baltic Sea offered any hope for most people. And so the German government got as many ships as it possibly could, including old, beautiful liners, ocean liners that they had before the war, those and freighters, and to try to rescue as many people as possible from the Eastern Front. And that would be in the areas, what today would be the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, or the areas of East Prussia. The people went to the ports there to try to get on these ships and escape. And we're talking in the middle of winter. We're talking in the middle of a terrible winter, one of the worst ever in Germany's history. People freezing in wagons, people freezing indoors, in door sills where they try to get some sleep. But the ships themselves, well, for instance, let me give you maybe the worst account. I'll say this. This is the Wilhelm Gustloff, and probably some of your listeners, in fact, I can guarantee some of your listeners know something about the Wilhelm Gustloff. It was a former ocean liner before the war. It would seat, or you could put roughly 2,300 people on that ship comfortably, and it would go see the world. People would go out, workers who had been working in this wonderful miracle that was Germany in the 1930s would be rewarded by a cruise on one of these ships, the Wilhelm Gustloff and others. And so the Wilhelm Gustloff, when it drew up to port in, I think it was Göttingen, one of the ports, there were 50, 60,000 people trying to get on a boat that was designed for just 2,000. And so you have enormous amounts of people desperate to escape the Soviets, trying to get aboard this ship and every other ship that docked there and elsewhere. And when the Wilhelm Gustloff finally sailed away that evening with its full load of people, it had roughly 8,000-9,000 people in a ship that was built for 2,000. And before they even left the port, another 1,000 or 2,000, I can't remember the numbers right now, but another large group of people got on board the Wilhelm Gustloff. And if you can imagine sailing out in this cold Baltic Sea with ice in it, and the wind is like 20 degrees below. That's how. So everyone has to be inside. You cannot sit out on the decks on this ship in this time of the year. But if you can imagine that many people on a ship built for that number of people, well, everything goes to pieces very quickly. The toilets are automatically flooded within probably less than an hour, more likely a few minutes, from overuse. People just constantly using the restrooms. The heating, the everything went to pot quickly. So we've got nightmare conditions, people screaming, children crying. Down below in the hold, there were wounded soldiers that they put aboard. A few hours after the Wilhelm Gustloff left port, a Soviet submarine spotted it and put a couple of torpedoes into the side. And it, of course, everyone was terrified by the sounds and the vibration of the ship alone. And people rushed outside looking for a way off this ship. The Wilhelm Gustloff was torpedoed by the Russian submarine. And the people, naturally, their first impulse was to get outside the ship and try to save themselves from sinking. But of course, the razor winds were just incredible. And the intercom on the ship came aboard and came on, and it basically said, don't panic, don't panic. The ship is not going to sink. Go back inside. Everything will be okay. And, of course, it wasn't. Half an hour later or less, the bulkheads broke down below, and the water came rushing in, and the ship very quickly turned on its side. We've got anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people, depending on who's doing the counting, desperate to survive this sinking ship. Very few of them did. And in the long and short of it all is that somewhere around 7,000, 8,000, even 9,000 people drowned. Only a few hundred survived, so you can do the math. And that's just one ship, the Wilhelm Gustloff. There were other ships. There was the General Steuben, I believe it had over 7,000, and most of those people, except for a few hundred, died. And this is a Baltic massacre. It's an attempt to kill every person there is escaping on these ships. There were many other ships that were sank. Some actually reaching port in Western Germany were attacked by British and American airplanes, and they were sank there. And so after making this terrible trip across the Baltic Sea, they arrive in port only to be killed there. It's a massacre of almost prodigious proportions. And it's, again, one of those terrible war crimes that the victors did and could do and not have any fear of justice.
They must have had something to show that they were civilian ships, that they were rescue ships, that they had refugees on. They must have had some kind of flags or some kind of paint, as well as letting people know on the, you know, over the radio that they were civilian ships. Surely they must have had something.
Well, let me say this. At this point of the war, bombers are actually targeting buildings with red crosses on top. And they can see clearly that this is a hospital. They can look down from the above, and the bombs are still falling on the hospitals. So there is no such thing now as a Geneva Convention. The winners are making the laws right now. They're doing what they want to do, and that's kill Germans and just keep killing Germans. And so they know there really is not a Geneva Convention. People may pay lip service to the rules of land warfare and the Geneva Convention about the treatment of civilians, but it doesn't matter. The Allies are where they want to be, and that's exactly what they're doing right now, is killing everybody they can find. And the slaughter at sea was no different than the slaughter on the land. And the slaughter on the land, we've got the slaughter from the air, we've got the slaughter at sea, but the slaughter on land, yes, slaughtering civilians, of course, soldiers, it's an automatic, you kill them, but on the Eastern Front especially, Soviet armored patrols would just roll over the refugees and their trucks. They would be in their wagons being pulled by horses, or in trucks or cars, and the Soviets' tanks would just roll over them on the roads, basically flatten them as flat as cardboard. These type of things are just going on. In fact, any bit of humanity that one can find in this, it's an aberration. It's an anomaly. It's something that's so rare that it seems strange and odd and peculiar when it's surrounded by this incredible evil, this evil that, you know, I have no more words in my vocabulary to come up with what's going on. It's monstrous. It's devilish. It's satanic. It's you could go on and on with this, but I mean, how much do you have to say that this was the most evil? The Allies were simply the most evil army ever created in world history. That's simple. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't individuals. I had two fathers who fought in that war, by the way. One was a biological father. One was an adoptive father. One fought against the Germans. One fought against the Japanese. And no, I don't hate either one of those guys, biological or the adoptive father. And so I know there was some good people there. But unfortunately, the leaders were not. Most of the leaders were absolutely evil. There are a few good leaders, like Patton and Montgomery, people like that. But nevertheless, they still stayed in the war to the very end. I wish they had had their better feelings. I wish it had come out earlier, and they had not fought in that war. I simply said, this is an abomination. I'm not going to fight in this war. George Patton, he made some comments that we all know about and we identify with. He said we were fighting on the wrong side. Well, what took him so damn long to figure that out, I ask? It's a pity that he didn't quit fighting when he realized that, but he didn't. He stayed in the war to the end. It was absolutely the worst political leaders, the worst military leaders that the world has ever seen, period. Put the two together and you have a terrible atrocity like the crimes committed in Germany.
I think the Germans were following the Geneva Convention, weren't they? The Americans at the end of the war said, well, we'll designate the Germans as unarmed combatants, so we don't have to obey the Geneva Convention. The Soviet Union had never signed up to the Geneva Convention anyway. Churchill appears to have just been ignoring it, whereas Hitler had his men following the Geneva Convention, apart from as far as the Soviet Union was concerned. So it seems to be he was the only one that was following it.
It's true. It's true. And people say, well, that's very convenient of you. You're a Nazi anyway, so why not basically let them slide in this? Fact is, many Americans said the very same thing. They said Germany lived up to the Geneva Convention, quote, to a T, end quote. That this is things that the Americans are saying and the British are saying. Both Patton and Montgomery, let it be said that both of them didn't partake in this post-war slaughter that Eisenhower initiated. That is, you mentioned that Eisenhower designated the German POWs, roughly 5 million that fell into his hands at the end of the war. He designated them as DEFs, Disarmed Enemy Forces. And he did that so that he wouldn't have to designate them as POWs, which are protected under the Geneva Convention. So by, in his mind at least, by designating them disarmed enemy forces meant that he could do basically anything he wanted to do with them, and he did. He did. Of the 5 million that were in his control, roughly maybe as many as 1.5 million died from starvation and from dehydration, even though the Rhine River very often ran just beyond the barbed wire. Men dying of thirst, men dying from lack of shelter, simple shelter to keep the cold rain off in the spring, people being, in fact, being murdered, simply murdered, and not allowing any food to come in from the villages nearby. There are many people more than willing to feed the starving POWs, or DEFs, as Eisenhower calls them, but they would be shot. They could be killed for trying to deliver food. And it's not the excuse is used to this very day in some history books that, well, Europe was starving. And so it's only fitting that the people who started the war and perpetuated the war and committed so many crimes in the war, that is the Germans, should be the last to get anything to eat. That's not true. That's not so. There were plenty of food. There's plenty of food in Europe. Yes, there was some things that were missing in a normal diet. But for instance, Denmark had a plenty of beef that they were more than willing to send south just across their border to Germany to feed some prisoners and to feed the people themselves, quite honestly. In Switzerland, the International Red Cross was denied entry into Germany, where they wanted to deliver trainloads of food to the prisoners that were being allowed to die of starvation by Eisenhower. This was a deliberate attempt to starve and kill as many Germans as he possibly could. And Eisenhower was happy with it. You know, this was a desk general. Eisenhower has got people think he's a great military leader. He was a politician. He was an orchestrator, you might say. He was a lead man, the lead military man, but he had never heard a bullet fired in anger. So he was not a soldier, so to speak. He was not a military man. He knew nothing about that. In fact, he never got his butt anywhere near firing, actual firing going on. So his hatred, his malice, his malicious murderous instincts towards Germans all had to do with his instinct. In other words, not what he saw. And by the way, the Germans, yes, to a T, according to many Americans, said they treated us a lot better. In other words, they obeyed the Geneva Convention. Prisoners were supposed to be fed and treated like you would want your own men to be treated. That is, given food and given comfort, given blankets, given shelter. And the Germans did this. And the Americans were, many of them were, the Americans as they were coming through toward Germany. Yes, there was an understood, unwritten law that you just killed every prisoner, every German prisoner, soldiers, that is. But when the Germans finally surrendered in mass, that is by the millions at the end of the war, then you couldn't just simply kill 2 or 3 million here without somebody finding out. That is the International Red Cross, someone like that. So that's why Eisenhower put his POWs in these various concentration camps and gave his commandants the orders, basically, they shouldn't get anything.
I don't think it was just the Germans there that got that sort of treatment either. Others rushed over to the West so that they could surrender to Britain, basically, rather than having to surrender to the Soviets. And they thought they were safe, and they were loaded up on trains, told they were going back home, and sent to the Soviets, or they were just sent to an area where they were shot in the head by the Soviets. And this was the British that turned them over, the Croatians and some other Slavic groups, I think.
For the most part. First of all, I should say I am not an expert on World War II. There are things that maybe I don't know about that did not get into this book, but I do. There's a few things that did stick out to me. And the Germans themselves said that. It said, when things get bad, the British will be the only gentlemen we run into. And they were right on so many occasions. Montgomery actually would turn his prisoners loose after taking their guns, of course. Now, what you're saying, I think you're talking about something called Operation Keelhaul.
Yeah, and the Blyberg massacre as well. That was the one.
Yes. This was something terrible, and it's a real stain upon the British name, quite honestly. Of course, the Americans, they did the same thing, and but they didn't care for the most part. But Operation Keelhaul, some of your listeners may have heard of this, but millions of Russians, took the opportunity when they could to flee the Soviet army, quit fighting for it. They hated communism, and they went over to the Germans, gladly joined the Germans because they wanted to return to Russia and free their country from Jewish Bolshevism, and many of these millions that after the war were, you know, suddenly this is terrible because now the Soviets are in control, at least in the East. The Americans, which aren't any better, are in control in the West, and we're screwed, royally. But toward the end of the war, there were lots of pronouncements, it's not in the American or British nature to turn these people back over to their executioners, which they knew that would happen if they did it. Well, guess what? They did. They made these fancy announcements for home consumption so the people themselves would hear this, that they would never turn the Russians, not just the Russians. I'm not talking about just Russian soldiers because some people could say, well, that's what they deserve. They're traitors. They left their own army. But you've got to understand, they didn't adhere to what their army was doing as far as the communist Bolsheviks were doing. And so they were basically fighting for freedom when they came over to the Germans. But I'm talking also about civilians, Russian civilians who escaped Russia to Germany, to Poland, places like that where they'd be free. And these people were also turned back to the Russians after the war. The Russians, the Soviets demanded them back, and the Americans and British were happy to deliver. And many of the soldiers who did this, of course, they were probably to the very day they died, they were so ashamed of themselves that, I'm sure many of them became alcoholics. That's the only way to escape something like this. To remember when you were a young man with a weapon in your arm, on your arms, and you are ordered to turn these people back onto railroad cars and trucks and send them back to their executioners. That is the Russians and the Cossacks and other people from the Soviet Union, turn them back to their executioners. And they, these poor people, this Operation Keelhaul, the people that were involved in this, the victims, that is, they fought tooth and nail. They fought to the death. They sometimes committed suicide rather than be grabbed by the Americans and the British and turned back to the Russians. But I'm not doing this good enough. I'm not doing a good enough job with this. I apologize for it. But there's at least a couple of books out there that deal with Operation Keelhaul, and anybody interested can read more about that. It's one of the most terrible acts of treachery ever committed in world history, because the Russians were told that they would not be sent back to their executioners, that the Americans and the British, they understood. Got to apologize again for my barking dog.
That's all right. Right.
Do we have a moment? I can go.
Come back in a minute. We have we talked a bit about this. Myself and Dennis did this Operation Keelhaul, and with the Russians, and how they thought they were going to be safe in Britain. Some of them were even actually taken back to Britain before they were then sent back off to Russia. And with the Blyberg massacre, it was Dennis's father managed to escape that from happening to himself. He managed to get further across Europe and actually get all the way to Britain. And it was his friends that were caught up in this massacre. That's why Dennis does what he does. But I can't recall the name of the book. Perhaps Thomas will be able to let us know the name of the book when he gets back. We did do some coverage of it, and also Churchill's links to it as well. I mean, you think of Churchill, Stalin, and Eisenhower. It's just like a trinity of evil. They're the most evil world leaders I think we've ever had. Can you recall the name of the book that dealt with Operation Keelhaul? I did some coverage of it with Dennis, but I can't recall the name of the book.
If I had a book in front of me, I could look in the bibliography and find it. I can't recall. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just wanted. We've got 12 minutes to go. But so we've been talking about what happened to the soldiers that surrendered at the end. But what about the expulsions of the Germans from the lands that they'd lived in for hundreds of years at the end of the war? These big, long,
most people probably don't realize that the Germans were not just in Germany alone. The Germans throughout the centuries had migrated to other areas, generally close to Germany. In other words, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia. They were generally, in fact, the nations themselves where the Germans settled were highly welcoming, because the Germans were known as thrifty farmers, people who could grow crops and feed nations. That's how good the German was as a farmer. And so they had no problem moving in, but the Germans were also very successful, and that was resented by some of the people over the centuries, of course. They were very successful and became wealthy as a result. And so with the war's end, the German was the most hated person on earth, from the propaganda for the most part, and the fact that they lost the war and the people believed the propaganda about how terrible they were. And so a year or so after the war, there was a deal cut between Churchill and FDR and Truman, which was the new American president, and other leaders. About giving the Soviet Union more land, more territory, because after all, they had fought the lion's share of the war, but also giving other nations more land that the Germans had formerly owned. And there were millions of Germans living beyond the borders of Germany in the nations I've just named. And all of these people were suddenly just ordered off. They were ordered off to get back to Germany if they could. but get out of the lands where they were at. And there were purges in certain places, especially places like Czechoslovakia. Terrible purges where the people themselves, the Czechs, killed Germans, killed them in the streets, committed just terrible, barbaric, savage acts against the Germans themselves. And so the Germans were told to get off the land, and the people they were living among, that is the other nationalities, were there to make sure they got off the land. In other words, it was leave or die, generally. Or the other nation, the other people would just simply take their farms, allow them to starve. So there was no recourse except to escape back to Germany. And Germany, of course, at the time was just absolutely a destroyed nation. This was not a wealthy place they were returning to. This was not a place of many homes and places to work. They had to leave, go back to this wasteland. And again, much of the movement, much of the migration of the Germans was in winter, of course. Seems like it's always winter. But they died, of course, by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, by the hundreds of thousands. And ultimately, of the 15 million or so that were kicked off their, kicked out of their homes in these various lands, 2 million died. A good percentage of them were of women and children, of course, because that's what was there. The men were, the soldiers, that is, the German soldiers, were in the Siberian mines and forests as slaves. And the others in Eisenhower's death camps, of course, many of them were dead, or many of them were still slaves in France and Britain and Canada and the United States, basically. They were still slaves, the soldiers. So most of the people who fled the farms and fields of their former homes in these other nations were women and children and old people, again. And so when they weren't killed and when they weren't frozen to death, they were often murdered by the people they met along the way, on the way back to Germany. That's a terrible, terrible story in itself. 2 million people out of roughly 15 million dying on this march of death. And of course, it really didn't get much better when they got back to Germany, because there was nothing there. Towns would have signs saying, go on, move on. We're full. We can't even feed the people we got. Keep moving. And many people did keep moving. There was no place to stop, though, unfortunately. It is a and the people that are doing this trek are actually moving with these treks. They're being beset by people virtually every mile of the way, every kilometer. You've got gypsies. You've got Jews. You've got people running loose right now that can commit any crime and get away with it. They're not going to go to prison. They're not going to be put to death for raping people, for murdering people, for stealing everything they've got, which is almost nothing to begin with. I had very many accounts in the book, of course, from people, those who did survive, telling about what it was like to be on these treks. And those people who did get back to Germany, and as I mentioned, 2 million of them didn't reach Germany. They died in Germany because they died of starvation. There was nothing there, and they died from just being murdered. This is a time in world history where there is a people that has no friend whatsoever to help them. You survive or you die, and many died. How the others survived is a terrible, terrible way to try to live, begging, eating weeds. I mean, it just goes on. There's thank goodness I wasn't asked to describe the book itself, because I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it justice. The good news is I was writing the book and I had my time. I could take my time and put this all together and make it, have it make sense.
But it's incredible, you know. We hear about like these death marches moving from the camps, and for some reason the Germans just decided to move these Jews from one camp to the other. When in actual fact they had to take the prisoners with them, so that the Soviets didn't get to them. And yet at the end of the war we've got this going on. We've got the largest ethnic cleansing that ever took place in Europe of Germans being forced on these death marches, and you hear nothing about it. And the Germans can't talk about it. They can't, you know, they have to look at it as a good thing, because it was the bad Nazis that lost the war. And yet it's this horrific wound in the soul of the German nation that is still there festering. You know, I'd like to get into some of your thoughts on the psychology of it all, but I don't think we're going to have the time tonight, Thomas. Do you want to let people know where they can find your book? You were just bringing up the actual book there, and the audio book and the video, and where people can find that, and where the people can find your blog and get hold of you.
Yes, but again, I guess I want to apologize, because this has been a random, unconnected talk, more or less, and I hope the book is better. Better may not be the word, but I hope the book would be more understandable. But the book is for sale at Money Tree Publishing. A person who's interested in the book can go to Money Tree Publishing, three words, and it's for sale there. And it's also for sale there along with the narrated version of Hellstorm, the audio book, something that's been, it's a work of art. The gentleman who narrated this, named Paul English, he was moved by the book so much so that he wanted to do this, and we both agreed it'd be probably a valuable learning tool for millions of people. But it's for sale there also, the narration, and also the very, very popular DVD of Hellstorm, by a man named Kyle Hunt. This is something that's been banned around the globe. It was banned, but it's still millions of people did get a chance to see this thing. And of course, it's a shortened version of the book and the narration, the audiobook, but it's also very well done. It's a very, I don't think you're going to forget. In fact, I know you won't forget either one of these, the book, the audiobook, or the DVD. But, at Money Tree Publishing, you can buy all three together or one single. You can buy the book or the audiobook or the DVD separately. But yes, again, I do apologize for my limitations as far as describing this. It's almost impossible in an interview to
I think we've done hit, fine.
To hit the places you really want to hit. And but it's a terrible war, and we to read this, to understand this, to hear it, to see it in the DVD. Hopefully it'll create something in everyone to say to themselves, let's not ever do this again. This is a crime that's so black and dark and vicious that we cannot ever let this loose again, this type of war.
That's the thing, isn't it? It can't just be forgotten about. It has to be talked about. It has to be confronted, and you have to find some kind of a resolution. This is the, you know, this is the terrible thing. The Germans cannot talk about it. They cannot come to a resolution. They've got this wound, and it's just festering there. And they're told just not to look at it. Pretend it's a good thing. It's horrific. You're doing a great thing by bringing this information to everyone, basically, and hopefully people will buy the book who haven't yet bought the book, and will watch the film. It's a very, very harrowing documentary, all of them very well made, the audio book, the video, and obviously the book's well written. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Tom. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you, and of course we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.